This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. I'm Santita Jackson, coming to you live from the largest progressive talk radio station in the United States, WCPT 820 AM and AM 950 Radio, my brothers and sisters to the north up in Minneapolis, St. Paul. It's a grand, grand day, February 26th, Friday, everybody. Ooh, let's knock it out. We've got to talk about this minimum wage today. What do you think about that? What do you think about the minimum wage? They say it's a no-go. What do you say? What do you say? Call me. Text me at 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278. I want to hear what your thoughts are about that. This could lift 40 million Americans, at the least, out of poverty. Most low-wage jobs in America, and women are disproportionately impacted by minimum wage, are held by women. In fact, the 25 lowest-paying jobs in the United States are all held by women. Wow. And this COVID-19 recession depression, depending upon where you are, and really it is all over America, it's hit women disproportionately. We lost the jobs. So what do you think about that? Dr. Julianne Malveau and a wonderful cast of brilliant, brilliant panelists will be on to talk with us about that. But there's one missing place at the table, and that's you. So we want you to call us, text us at 773-763-9278, 773-763-9278. Thank you, GWC Injury Lawyers, for giving us the opportunity to text. And so let's get right to it. Let's get to some of these headlines because we've got some good news, and I want to hear from Pastor Williams because I need to be lifted up today. Wow, what happened yesterday, everybody? There's a Senate ruling from the parliamentarian that says that Democrats cannot put $15, the minimum wage, in the COVID relief bill. The parliamentarian, who is the in-house referee, according to this NBC News report, ruled that the provision was not compliant with the rules governing the budget process, and that Congress is using the bill to pass is using to pass the bill with simple majorities. And of course, Chuck Schumer said we're disappointed in the decisions. And President Biden said a few weeks ago privately with American governors that he did not expect it to pass. So what do you think about that? Well, there is something that Kamala Harris could do. She could ignore this advisory opinion. It's not a rule. It's just an advisory opinion. And she could fulfill President Biden's promise, campaign promise, to boost the wage. What should she do? What will she do? What are you going to press them all to do? Well, the first known, and very careful to say, the first known strikes of the Biden presidency happened last night. U.S. airstrikes targeted Iran-backed militia facilities in Syria. What will that mean? What will the implications be? Well, some people are saying that this is yet another example of American imperialism. Our friends at Common Dreams said, sparking swift criticism of U.S. imperialism, the United States on Thursday carried out airstrikes ordered by President Biden on facilities in Syria that government officials told reporters belong to Iran-backed militia groups. Retaliation for a trio of recent rocket attacks on bases in Iraq that house U.S. troops. What do you think about that? We're going to be talking about that today as well. The Capitol Hill police say that extremists want to blow up the Capitol, and they might try to do that when President Biden addresses Congress to give his State of the Union address. Acting Chief, Acting U.S. Chief, U.S. Capitol Police Chief, Yogananda Pittman said this, quote, "We know that members of the militia groups that were present on January 6th have stated their desires that they want to blow up the Capitol and kill as many members as possible with a direct nexus to the State of the Union, which we know that date has not been identified," she told members of Congress, referring to the president's first address to a joint session of Congress. She said it's based on information. So what do you think about that, everybody? In the meantime, a Trump-appointed judge ruled that the eviction moratorium is unconstitutional. What will that mean? Will people be put out of their homes. Wow. And as former President Trump prepares to go to CPAC to launch his bid to get more Republicans in office in 2022, some people are saying that he is launching his 2024 bid. And guess what? Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said this. Well, a lot can happen between now and 24. I've got at least four members I think are planning to run for president, plus some governors and others. There's no incumbent, a wide open race, and should be fun for all to cover. But he says that he would absolutely support Trump if he were the 2024 nominee. Wow. What do you think about that? Everybody, like and share. And please go to my YouTube page, the Santita Jackson Show page. We want you to like and subscribe. We need you to like and subscribe. And we want to... We want to continue to grow these numbers and on and on. Got some good news for you in the coming weeks. Got some good stuff that's coming our way. The Santita Jackson Show. We're all family here. So let's get right to it. Pastor Tisha Williams, she has become a favorite of ours very, very quickly. She's the author of this book, I See You, Sis, Inspirations from Heroic Women of the Bible. And, of course, she is the pastor at the First Baptist Church in Bridgeton, New York, one of the few women to pastor a church really in all the world. It's very hard for women to get pastorships, but when you hear her preach, you understand how and why the First Baptist Church of Bridgeton, New York, got her on board, and we're so glad that she's part of the Santita Jackson Show. Pastor, what's the good news today?
Good morning, Santita. Good morning, listeners. Thank you, as always, for having me. So today I want to talk to someone and encourage them by saying you are released. I don't know what has you bound today, what's holding you prisoner, what you need to let go of, as we were talking about, but today you are released. I'm going to hang my hat here in the book of Ezra, one we don't visit very much, but it lets us know that in the first year, King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord fulfilled the prophecy that he'd given Jeremiah and had stirred in the heart of Cyrus to put a proclamation in writing stating that the Lord of God, Lord God of heaven, had given him all the kingdoms of the earth and had appointed him to rebuild a temple in Jerusalem. God stirred in the hearts of the priests and the Levites and the leaders of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin to go to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple of the Lord. That's where we're hanging our hat this morning. I have a question. Have you ever watched a hamster in a cage? When I consider it, a hamster in a cage more than any other animal is an example of what it means to be captive. To be captive means to be kept within bounds, and that's exactly what the hamster is, captive in a cage. And interestingly, some people live their lives like hamsters in a cage. A hamster looks outside the glass of the cage and sees freedom and decides to run for it. And so he hops on his wheel and begins to run for his freedom until he realizes he's not getting anywhere. So he runs faster. And an hour later, he's still in the same spot. So many of us have been trying to break a habit for years, 5, 10, 15, 20 later, 20 years later, only to find we're still in the same spot. We can see freedom, and yet we're unable to attain it. Why does this happen? Well, because like the hamster, we're using the wrong method. When we're trapped, we can't change things ourselves. The only way for a hamster to find freedom is for the owner of the hamster to reach inside the cage and lift it out of there. Somebody bigger than the hamster must take over. Trying to get out of your cage situation using your own human effort is not good enough. You need someone bigger than you to take over. Well, I have good news for you today, listeners. God is taking over. Even right now, God is reaching into your situation and lifting you out of captivity. Whatever that is, locked down by life, detained by debt, caged in conformity, restricted by your relationship, imprisoned by impossibility, wherever you find yourself captive today, let me start with the good news. God is reaching in and lifting you out today. And that's exactly what God does here in this text of Ezra. The Babylon nation has been conquered, the nation that carried the prisoners away 70 years prior. The exiles have spent a lifetime in captivity. We can relate. This past year has felt like a lifetime of captivity. Consider all that we've been through. When our doors first closed, seemed like a lifetime ago. The first day of homeschooling seems like a lifetime ago. We've been wearing masks and overwashing our hands and spraying our packages and groceries for what seems like a lifetime. Is it just me, or has this pandemic felt like we've spent a lifetime in captivity? In his first year, Cyrus allows the Jews who want to do so. Ooh, I wish I had time to talk about this. Who want to return to their homeland. Don't you know there are people, Santita, who are offered freedom yet choose captivity? I can't got to tell you, though, that's not living. It's existing. You are just going through the motions and spinning your wheels like that little hamster in the cage. In truth, a life in captivity is no life at all, no matter how much you try to make it so. God wants you to be released today, because God didn't call you to be a hamster. God called you to be a peacock. I lost somebody right there. They said, what in the world are you talking about at 6 o'clock in the morning? If you notice, when you go to the zoo, peacocks are never in a cage. You don't observe peacocks from behind a glass. As a matter of fact, peacocks walk around. They have the full run of the place. They're strutting and fanning their plumes and feathers for everyone to see. I'm trying to tell you, it's time for you to make the transition from spinning to strutting. Are you ready to be released today? First of all, your release is written. The Bible tells us that Cyrus was put this proclamation in writing. A proclamation by the king was powerful. It was permanent. What are you saying, Pastor? I'm saying that long before you found yourself in captivity, God already secured your exit. It is written. Come here, Paul. There has no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above what you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that you might be able to bear it. Let me help you here. A couple of years ago, my friends and I participated in an Escape the Room challenge. And the Escape the Room Challenge is a real-life team-based puzzle game where people are locked in a room and have to solve a series of puzzles to get out or escape in the allotted time. But before we entered the room, the game master gave us a walkie-talkie and informed us that if we found ourselves stuck at any time, we could all call and ask for a hint to get us through the next test. Then the game master also informed us that if we found ourselves completely overwhelmed and unable to make it, all we had to do is call, and he let us out. You see, there's a way out before you even go in. All we had to do was summon the game master. God is our game master. God makes a way of escape before you even go in. Your situation didn't catch God off guard. It's not a surprise to God. When you need help, call your game master. He made a way out of that relationship, a way out of your financial crisis, a way out before you even received the diagnosis. Don't you know that God right now is behind the scenes orchestrating your release? That ought to make somebody excited today. Cyrus was stirred up. He was compelled to do something great for these people. God is excited. Get excited, listeners, because God is stirring people on your behalf, and they don't even know what's going on. They're going to think it's their idea, but God has been stirring the whole time. That executive on your job is saying, I know, I'll give her the project. The loan officer is saying, I'll give them the loan. The teacher is saying, I know, I'll give them extra credit. God is stirring. Your release was ordained years ago. Your deliverance years ago. It was never about being in captivity. It's always been about being released from captivity. Now, you're probably wondering what happened with me and my friends. I'm happy to say that we successfully escaped the room. Not only did we escape, but we also defied the odds. The room that we were in only had a 20% success rate. See, your release is going to defy the odds. Your release is going to confound the wise. The odds are stacked against you. No one is expecting you to make it out. But nevertheless, God has already ensured your emancipation. And every escape the room has a theme. Ironically, ours was called the virus. Isn't that something? I didn't know 2 years ago that gaming would come to depict life. And so after we escaped the room, I began to sing a little song. I said, I've been through the virus, but I got out. I changed the words of Brian Poppin's song, I've been through the fire, but I got out. You see, the Israelites weren't released for no reason. Then God stirred the hearts of the priests and the Levites. The Levites, the first church choir, the singers were released first, and there was a reason for it. They were released in order to praise. In other words, release should lead to your worship. Release to hallelujah. Release to Shabbat. Release to Barak, release to Yada and Toda. I can see the children of Israel marching down the road from Barilon. Can you hear them singing en route? We've been through the exile, but we got out. We've been through captivity, but we got out. What's your song today? I've been through the chemo, but I got out. I've been through the foreclosure, but I've got out. I've been through the depression, but I got out. I've been through the abuse, but I got out. Come on, sing it with me. I've been through the embarrassment, but I got out. Sing to the Lord a new song. I've been through the fight, but I got out. I've been through the grief, but I've got out. I've been through the gossip, the anger, the insecurity, the up and down, but guess what? I got out. The song goes on to say, no matter what you're going through, God's going to make a way for you. And soon you're going to say, I got out. You've been released today. And that's the good news.
Amen. You've been released today. I needed to hear that today. I don't know about you, everybody. Shirley from Philadelphia, Deborah, D. Ray, Dr. Deborah Furholden. But I needed to be released. Come on. The struggle continues. Reverend the Pastor Tisha Williams, First Baptist Church out of Bridgehampton, New York. We're going to get some good news about COVID-19, because we are going to come through this storm. Dr. Deborah Furholden, Associate Dean of Public Health at Michigan State University. Dr. Deb, what is going on?
Good morning. Pastor Williams just dropped that word. As she was speaking, I started to pop my chest out like a peacock. I felt free. Struck. I was literally on the wheel working while she was talking, and I jumped off the wheel, and I spread my feathers. That was a word right there.
But you know what? Because mental health really is a part of our physical health. And I think one of the things that we love about you, Reverend, but you have a ministerial zeal about your work in the field of health. I mean, the fact is, we do need to be reassured, you know, and reassurance only comes with trust. And that is how we feel about you. And so thank you for that, because that's half the battle, knowing that I can get through it. And you bring that to us every day, Dr. Deborah Furholden, and we are beholden to you, and we are forever grateful to all that you do and have been doing. So, what you want to talk about today?
What she said that I think is critical. I've been getting calls, so I've been very clear. I do believe the choice to get this vaccine is a choice. I believe we have many other choices as well related to our overall health and well-being. And I don't know that people really experience all those choices, because I don't think they're getting all of the information, as she said, to really strut their stuff and experience their own freedom. So I got a call from a brother yesterday who was an absolute no. Flat out, no, I'm not getting it, all of that. He's a veteran. They don't call from the VA. Did your numbers come up? Did you take the vaccine?
Hold on, we lost you for a hot second. Okay, he's a veteran, and he was an absolute no.
He was an absolute no, and he's a veteran. And then he got a call from the VA that his number had come up, and he was now presented with a choice. And he's under 65. But in Michigan, they've lowered the age for certain groups to 60, and they've also created a new category of eligibles, and veterans are included. So he got a call, and where he had been on a pretty public campaign to say, I'm not getting it. He had a change of heart, and he decided to get the vaccine. And he got the vaccine last week, and we went live, and he shared about his experience and what had him have a change of heart. And then he called me yesterday in upset. And his upset is because he's now got a runny nose and the sniffles a week after getting his vaccine. And he says, Doc, I haven't had the sniffles. I haven't had a runny nose. He's up in arms. And you said that the vaccine doesn't contain the virus, but now I got symptoms of the virus after getting the vaccine. And I said, well, brother, do you have a cold? Like, it is February in Michigan. Do you have a cold? The fact of what's in the vaccine has not changed. Well, I haven't been around anybody, and I haven't done anything. And I said, well, when did you get the vaccine? I got the vaccine a week ago. I said, well, if you got the vaccine a week ago, what you're experiencing now a week later is not related to the vaccine. Well, I haven't been around anybody. I said, do other people live in your house? Well, yeah. Have those other people been places? Well, yeah. Is anybody else in your house have the sniffles? Well, yeah. And I just thought, wow, like it feels like people are just so hypervigilant right now. Mm-hmm. And it does. The experiences, they feel like they're caged, they're trapped, they're stuck. you know, all this stuff is happening out in the world, despite people not moving around a whole lot, people are getting this virus. And I didn't share with folks, but my daughter gave me permission. My daughter had COVID. She is now fully recovered. She came out of isolation yesterday. That was her 2-week, 14-day mark. And I just understand the toll that this is taking on people. So I'd like to pick up on what Sister Williams said and help them experience their own peacockness. Help them know that they have some power and they have some say in what's happening. So number one, I want to reaffirm for everybody, getting the vaccine is a choice. It is a choice. We're not fully at the effect of this, and we are all impacted. But how you choose to be about it will be everything. Now, I was able to have a conversation with him and talk him off of the ledge, but I don't know that others have that. And so I want to really encourage people. There are things that we should all be doing during this season that will further edify and support our overall health and well-being, such that if you were even exposed to this virus, you are giving yourself the maximum optimal opportunity for recovery. These basic health habits will help people, no matter if we're dealing with a pandemic, no matter if you're trying to prevent yourself from joining the roles of people with hypertension, of people with diabetes, of people with other chronic but preventable health conditions. So I want to talk a little bit about what people should be doing to shore themselves up. And it will help them independent of COVID-19 or anything else that's happening out in the world, because the reality of it is you do have a say. People have a say in their own health and well-being. And there are a couple things I want to point to for people. And I talked about this very early on, but I want to reaffirm this. Everybody, independent of the pandemic, should be standing in and claiming their own health. And there are very basic things that people could be doing. The first thing is,
Hold on. I got less than, you know, you hear the music. That means I got less than a minute to go. So what I want to do is hold you over for just a couple minutes, because we've got to talk about this, these Syrian bomb droppings in just a few minutes. But some people have some real questions, some things that they want to get in with the good doctor. And we're going to do that on the other side of the break. And we're going to talk through this, of course, on Facebook Live on the Santita Jackson and Friends page and on my YouTube page, The Santita Jackson Show. Talking to Dr. Deborah Verholden, COVID-19, you have some questions. In fact, Lorraine has some questions about DNA-based and mRNA-based vaccines. Got a lot. Yeah, get to it, everybody, on the Santita Jackson Show. Back in just a minute.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. Wow, we're going to be talking about the minimum wage today, and we are going to talk about that very shortly. But in the meantime, we've got to talk about the first known military strike of the Biden-Harris administration. U.S. airstrikes target Iranian-backed militia facilities. Now, progressives have said, okay, this is American imperialism run amok once again. And so I said, you know, let me go to someone who says that we need to imagine a world, and not just imagine, but create a world beyond war. Indeed, one of the leading progressives in this space, a brilliant organizer from Roots Action, the executive director of World Beyond War, David Swanson. I had to reach out to you, and thank you so much for reaching back last night, because I said, you got to be kidding me. What happened? What happened yesterday?
Well, not much has changed. You know, as you said, no minimum wage, no Medicare for all, no Green New Deal, no survival checks, no ending student debt, but the militarism rolls on and expands. And I do not believe this is the first bomb to fall from the sky since Biden entered the White House, not in Iraq or Syria or Afghanistan, of course, but it is sort of intended as a message and put out as a press release by the White House. We are engaging in a tit-for-tat, retributive, responsive, measured strike to do to Iranians what they did to us in exact measure, but they have no control over who strikes back when, and they're leaving completely out of the calculation what is enraging people in Iran and across the regions, which is the deadly sanctions that aren't ending and the broken promise on rejoining the agreement with Iran. The time is running out. Iran is going to get a new government this summer that is going to have no interest in any agreements whatsoever. This is the time to avoid war with Iran, and the Biden administration is not doing it.
What are they doing? Because we have not, we saw over the past 4 years, there was this pushback on, President Trump said, at least I haven't gotten you into a war. Well, no one is lifting up those policies. But that having been said, not getting into war is a big deal. But what could this lead to? You said that you're getting back at Iran, but you're doing this on Syrian soil. Where is this going?
Well, first of all, it is absolutely wonderful and tremendous and terrific that Donald Trump didn't start a major new war. Mm-hmm. This is a precedent that's been set and should be continued through every future president. But he escalated several wars that he inherited, and he moved them, as President Obama had been doing, further from ground wars to air wars, which means more people die, but an even higher percentage of them are the other people, the people who don't matter, the people on the other side. And this is what it looks like we're going to see from Biden and Blinken and his crew. I wouldn't underestimate the extent to which this particular bomb dropping is related to Saudi Arabia and the relationship there and kissing up. We haven't seen any checks to people who need them, but we have seen hundreds of billions of dollars in weapons sales to brutal dictatorships continuing under the Biden administration. What are they doing? Who knows what they're doing? There are 41 Congress members sent a letter yesterday to ask Joe Biden, exactly what are you ending in the war on Yemen and what are you not ending in the war on Yemen? And I'm not holding my breath for a response, but it's clearly not the entire war ending there.
We're talking with David Swanson, the executive director of World Beyond War. Is that what you want, everybody? Call me. We're going to be talking about the minimum wage in just a few minutes, but I had to get him because I said, as this story begins to unfold, we need to know what we're in because we're all in this. We all have a dog in the hunt, David Swanson, when it comes to these wars. And in fact, you have a hashtag, no honeymoon. No honeymoon for Biden. You said, in the wars. That's where you were at the beginning of this administration. And I was mindful of the fact that the media kept saying that, this is the first known bombing. What are we to make of all of this?
Well, we got a different imperialist militarist presidency, but we didn't get a presidency aimed at peace. We got a few promises, right, including in the Democratic Party platform. We got promises to end the war on Afghanistan, already broken. We got a promise to end the war on Yemen, partially, sort of, kind of. But we got someone who brought, to his inauguration the representative of the would-be coup leader in Venezuela, who, as far as we can tell, is still, 10 years later, intent on overthrowing the government of Syria. It's not just, bombs in Syria. It's U.S.-backed troops controlling much of the oil and the land in Syria with the intention of starving the Syrian people and overthrowing the government. You have people like Victoria Nuland put in power in the State Department now who were key to the coup in Ukraine and openly want to go after the government of Russia. So you've got military spending, as far as we can tell, is where there's plenty of money and it's going to roll on, over $4,000 every year from every U.S. Taxpayer. But they can't give $2,000 to people who need it in an economic crisis and a deadly disease pandemic. These are the priorities.
Is this ultimately about U.S. business interests?
Well, it's about U.S. weapons company business interests. Mm. It's not good for exposed business interests. It's not good for the U.S. economy. I mean, we look around and we see all these military jobs and we say, oh, well, for whatever it does to foreign relations and slaughtering children abroad and environmental destruction and the secrecy in government, well, at least it's a jobs program. It isn't true. It is a gross lie. Right? I mean, the economists have, there's no dispute among them. You get more jobs if you put the money in education or green energy or infrastructure, or even do not tax it from working people in the first place to put into military spending. So military spending reduces jobs. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for most businesses. But it is certainly in the interest of the incredibly expanded weapons industry and military contractor industry. They get more and more money. More and more of their money go into what we call campaign contributions. In other countries, we'd call it bribery. And this cycle continues. You have a congressional, you know, we just in recent days had a congressional committee set up that to give advice on what to do in Afghanistan, and they recommended keeping the war going in Afghanistan beyond the May deadline, keep the troops there. And the majority of them, I think over two-thirds of them, were people on this working group were people funded by the weapons industry, which is considered perfectly acceptable and normal.
How do you think the media, if you could, before you go, how are they reporting on this story? How would you grade them? What should we be looking for with them, from them?
You know, the USA Today yesterday had an incredible lengthy series of articles about the endless wars and spending and overseas military bases. I mean, lots of points I would argue with in it, predictably bad, but overwhelmingly positive, just miles beyond any other media outlet or, of course, any member of the U.S. Congress. So there are, you know, highlights, but in general, absolutely awful. And let me just say, for someone tied to Chicago, if this White House sends Rahm Emanuel to represent us to Japan or China, that's another absolute disgrace in a series. I mean, someone who tries to protect, you know, killer cops in Chicago to go where the U.S. has killer troops with legal immunity for their crimes in a place like Japan, absolute outrage. And the media won't tell you that either.
They sure don't. What should we be on the lookout for with this? Where do you expect this to go?
I think we have to be looking for any signs of life out of the U.S. Congress. There is legislation, including from Congresswoman Barbara Lee, to finally end the AUMF, the authorization for the use of military force. But there is supposedly this new caucus being formed by Congresswoman Lee and Congressman Bocan, the Military Spending Reduction Caucus. But it doesn't commit them to anything. It's just press releases. They're not committing to opposing increased military spending. And this is what we have to be demanding, as well as ending the war in Afghanistan.
Well, let me ask you this. When you have something like this, just very quickly before you go, when you have this kind of military campaign that is initiated, does that imperil troops in other theaters?
Does opposing wars imperil troops? I've never understood.
Because a lot of people oppose America's wars, endless wars. That is something that people discuss all around the country, and there's this populist movement that we're seeing all around the world that's opposing this. When this happens, when we lead this military strike, we're really on Syrian soil in the name of getting back at Iran when we're about to meet with the Saudis. All this stuff today. How does that impact the safety of troops and other theaters?
Well, I think the extent to which U.S. occupations and U.S. bombings create hostility and generate antagonism endangers U.S. troops and U.S. allies in bases around the world. And there's absolutely no reason for there to be U.S. special forces engaged in 85 countries and U.S. troops in the in virtually every country on Earth. I think what we ought to do for U.S. troops is, you know, go after that top enemy of the U.S. military, and that is end the student debt and make free college part of public education. The majority of people in the U.S. military say they are there because they had no other career options. That's a major reason why they're there. This is what the Pentagon fears the very most, is that the U.S. treats college like other wealthy countries treat it, and makes it a right, not a privilege.
Oh, you put a whole different spin on this. Why don't you say, wait a minute, if you open people up to college, you won't have, what do they call, the poor man's draft? Wow.
Well, that's right. There's a poverty draft. And they're talking now, of course, about expanding draft registration, literal draft registration, the selective service to women as feminism, as human rights. Again, women need the equal right to be forced against their will to go kill and die, in wars for profits. This is what the Democrats are bringing to Washington that the Republicans were resisting, not because they don't like wars, but because they're sexists and they don't think women should be allowed to do things. So now, as a measure of progress, we're going to expand the reservoir. We're going to double the people who could be drafted as soon as this endless blind militarism gets the U.S. into another major war.
David Swanson, everybody. World without, world beyond war, a world beyond war. I want you to go to that website. I want you to follow him on Roots Action. He just does such magnificent work. I want you to come back and speak with us at greater length, David Swanson, because you're helping us to look at this in a whole different way. One of the things that I love about you is intersectionality. You're connecting these wars to student loan debt, to the stimulus check, to everything that the minimum wage, everything that we're dealing with, everything that we say we don't have enough money to pay for. Oh, David Swanson, thank you so much for being with us. I had to reach out to him real late last night, but this is when this happened, so I said thank you. Thank you so much, David Swanson. Can't wait to have you back.
And me too. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. Executive Director of World Beyond War. Let's talk about this minimum wage. The minimum wage. Well, the parliamentarian, really the in-house referee for Congress, said this is a no-go. Now, mind you, that is advice. It is not a rule. It's not a ruling. It's advice. I don't think that this should be in this COVID-19 stimulus package. Now, the vice president could overrule that advice. Will she do that? What should we do? What should we be pushing for? What is the minimum wage anyway? What is a minimum wage? What is a livable wage? What is the difference? Will $15 an hour cut it for most Americans? Should it be scalable? There's so many questions I have. And so leading this panel today is a brilliant MIT-trained economist who's also the president emeritus of Bennett College for Women, brilliant educator and really political organizer and activist and critic. Of course, the brilliant Julianne Malveaux. And we've got attorney C.K. Hoffler, the president of the National Bar Association, which is the largest and oldest black bar association in the world. She's also the chair of Rainbow Push. And excuse me, Julianne Malveaux is the chair of Push Excel. Let me not forget that. And of course, we've got attorney Erin Connolly, another Rainbow Push organizer, but she, of course, has Covenant Strategies, brilliant political organizer and activist. Attorney Robert Petillo, Southeastern Regional Director for Rainbow Push. You've got to check out his radio show this weekend on WAOK on Sunday from 1 to 4 Eastern Standard Time, 12 to 3 Central Standard Time. Carol, for you and Bab out on the left coast, that's 10 to 1 p.m. every Sunday. And Dwight McKee, National Action Network and Rainbow Push, he has been with us a long, long, long time. Let me start with you, Dr. Malveaux. When we look at the minimum wage versus a livable wage, What did you make of yesterday's decision by the parliamentarian to, well, the suggestion, the advice to remove this from the package? And then we see the Senate is kind of signing on to that. What did you make of that?
Well, I thought it was a short-sighted decision. President Biden ran on the promise of increasing the minimum wage. And, of course, we have to get the Senate to agree. But this, you know, these Republicans are basically stuck. Mitt Romney came up with something that would give folks a $10 an hour minimum wage. And that's inadequate. The wage now, $7.25 an hour, has not been raised for 10 years, for more than 10 years, really. 10 years. I'm not doing the math in my head so well this morning. But so it was, you know, it was a short-sighted decision that was expected. But at the same time, and, you know, the, raising the minimum wage doesn't do a lot. It does something because $7.25, then it will go up to $9.50 as soon as the bill is passed, and then gradually up to $15, about a dollar and a half every year after that through 2025. At $7.25, a person who's working full-time, full year, is earning about $15,000 a year. That's a poverty line. That's a poverty line. So people are working when they're in poverty. And the thing about full-time, full year is that most people at low-wage jobs don't work full-time, full year. They're not working 52 weeks, 40 hours. Often they work fewer hours, and they have no sick leave, no vacation days. They just work. So in about 20-some states, the minimum wage is higher than $7.25. In Washington, D.C., it's $15. In Washington State, $14. So in some states, basically, they have increased the minimum wage because they realize that people can't live on that. Even if you go to the $15, it still is going to be very challenging for people. But the short-term, the decision that the parliamentarian made, I can't explain it. She says it's against the rules. Well, what, I don't know what rules she's looking at.
But Dr. Malvo, it's just advice. It's still something that the vice president has within her right to go past, according to reporting from David Sirota and others. Do you think that that's something that she ought to do? They did campaign on this.
Well, I think she should. I think this thing, first of all, is overtime. Increase the minimum wage. You or I or no one else who's listening would work without getting any raise whatsoever for 10 years. So, you know.
Well, you know, you wrote
put it that way.
Absolutely. You know, everyone, because I'm about to post to the Santita Jackson and Friends page this brilliant column. And, of course, she writes every week for the NNPA, and we can get it in our own crusader here in Chicago. And, Gary, when will workers get a break? That's what you said. You said, wait a minute. I mean, and the numbers that you pull, and you're a numbers person, brilliant economist, they're stunning. There were 18 million more unemployment insurance claims now than a year ago. Nearly 10 million fewer jobs than before the pandemic. And if you're just in a pandemic, to think that our jobs are connected to, are keyed into our health care is keyed into our employment, that's stunning. And people are really in a lot of pain out here. Where should the wage be scalable? Because a lot of small businesses say, wait a minute, I'm in South Carolina, I'm in Mississippi, I cannot afford for my small business to pay someone $15 an hour. And Joe Manchin is like, well, I'm in a poorer state. We're at $11 an hour, and that's better for people. Our people cannot afford $15 an hour. Of course, the cost of living in New York City is different and in California than it is in poorer areas. What do you think about it? Should it be scalable, or should we just have a minimum wage, a floor beneath which no person should fall?
Well, first of all, again, this is a 5-year gradual process. So any small business who says, oh, this is too much of a shock to my system, is not paying attention to the fact that it's a gradual process. So you're not going from $7.25 to $15 overnight. It's basically it changes. The second thing is, of course, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that we'd lose about 1 million jobs if the minimum wage was passed, if the minimum wage were raised. And many people, economists at the Economic Policy Institute and others, have disputed that claim. So that's worth noting as well. And then, you know, okay, Mississippi, West Virginia, well, you know, the states that have never raised the minimum wage are those, that southern swath. You look at Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Georgia. You know, they basically, I mean, they haven't raised a wage. They don't intend to raise a wage. They don't want to raise a wage. And I think there should be a federal minimum. And I don't necessarily think it should be scalable. I think that, you know, basically, here, one empirical piece of evidence. When Seattle, Washington passed the minimum wage in that city for $15, people said, oh, people are going to lose jobs, blah, 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 blah. They didn't. They did it. They lost, maybe a few jobs were lost, but then people ended up hiring people back because they found that, you know, productivity, they needed the productivity, they needed the workers. So we just have to be mindful of that. It is going to be a shock at first, of course. If Mississippi goes from $7.25 to $9.50, that's a third. That's about a 30% increase. But then after that, it's like 15%. But again, Mississippi costs less than New York does, but nobody should live at $15,000 a year.
You can't in America. You just cannot afford to do that. We're talking with the brilliant Dr. Julianne Malveaux, MIT-trained economist, president emeritus of Bennett College for Women down in Greensboro, North Carolina. Just before we go to break, let me just go to you very quickly, if you can give me your elevator pitch, Attorney C.K. Hoffler, because you deal with these cases. I mean, you have been working with this gentleman who sued Amazon because they gave him grief because he said, look, my workers have COVID. I mean, and you're dealing with workers who are being mistreated all the time, C.K. What do you make of this?
Well, good morning, Santita and friends. I think that this is a good thing. For one, the Biden-Harris team campaigned on this. And so I think to change midstream would not be a good thing politically. But secondly, if we think of the cost of living in the United States, there are many people that live below poverty. So we need to really, even, and I'm a small business owner, it's gradual. And I think this is something we need to embrace. We really have to think about those, the least of these, who are supporting our economy, who are working in jobs, and stop thinking about, well, I'm a business owner, and I can't afford it, and all this kind of stuff. Because we have to make way. We have to grow the economy. We have to make sure that the workers are protected.
Everybody said, what do you think about that? Call me, text me at 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278. Have a magnificent panel here. Dwight McKee is here. Of course, attorney Robert Petillo is here. But wait a minute, hold on. Erin Connolly's here. And excuse me, Dr. Malveaux, guess who has a new radio show? C.K. Hoffler, W-A-O-K, down in Atlanta, every Tuesday from 11 to 12. Eastern Standard Time, 10 to 11, Central Standard Time. Come on now. She's not going to say it. I'm going to say it. You got to tune in. You don't want to miss this. Robert Petillo, you got some company
Thank
at WAOK. That's right. Back in just a few minutes. Talking about this minimum wage. Back in a minute.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. Like and share, like and share, like and share. It's Friday, February 26, 2021. We're streaming on the Santita Jackson and Friends page on WCPT820.com, AM950radio.com. Ah, the new Santita Jackson Show page on YouTube. streaming over there too. So everybody, please like and subscribe over there, and just join us and get in this conversation on the minimum wage on the Santita Jackson Show. And today I want you to call me or text me at 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about this. And of course, GWC Injury Lawyers gives you the opportunity to text. We want to hear what you're thinking. Is $15 an hour enough to make it in America? And remember, I think only one in 10 of these minimum wage jobs are held by teenagers. This is what grown people make their money now. And as I've heard, people have grown folks' bills, and these folks are working hard every day. What do you think about that? What do you think about this resistance to living the minimum wage to a living wage? What is all of that? Of course, we've got a tremendous panel to talk about that. And so before we get back to the panel and get to your calls, I want you to know that we're going to get to a few of these headlines. Of course, today we're expecting a high of 40 degrees in Chicago. It's going to be positively spring-like, mostly sunny. Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950 radio, my buddies up to the north. 40 degrees, mostly cloudy. The Dow closed down, wow, yesterday, 559 points. The S&P down 96 points. The NASDAQ was down 478 points. Everybody, what is going on with the minimum wage? Bernie Sanders says he will not give up on the $15 minimum wage. We will deal with this, he says. How are they going to do it? The Senate has a ruling from the parliamentarian. Who is the parliamentarian? The parliamentarian is the in-house referee for Congress. And the in-house referee said that the provision was not compliant with rules governing the budget process that Congress is using to pass the bill with simple majorities. And so Chuck Schumer said, I'm disappointed in this decision. And other people have pointed out, well, this is advice. Now, will Democrats consent? Ro Khanna, the congressman from Northern California, said, I'm sorry, an unelected parliamentarian does not get to deprive 32 million Americans the raise they deserve. Ilhan Omar said, abolish the filibuster, replace the parliamentarian. Let's get cracking, everybody. I want to know what you think. And some people are saying, according to this report from David Sirota, that our vice president really has a tremendous amount of power here. A key Senate official advised Democratic lawmakers that the chamber's rules do not allow them to include a minimum wage increase. That was a parliamentarian. And this ruling means that Vice President Kamala Harris could decide the fate of one of the Democratic Party's most significant and sacred campaign promises. But it remains unclear about what she will do. She could ignore this advisory opinion. She could do that. Will she do that? In the meantime, yesterday, the first known airstrike, the first known military action by the Biden-Harris administration, happened yesterday. Indeed, President Biden directed U.S. military airstrikes in eastern Syria against facilities belonging to what the Pentagon said were Iran-backed militia, a calibrated response to rocket attacks against U.S. targets in Iraq. What will happen? Many people are saying that this might help him with the Saudis, with whom he will be meeting today. That is President Biden. What do you think about that? In the meantime, the U.S. Capitol Police Chief Yogananda Pittman said on Thursday that extremists want to, quote, blow up the Capitol on or around the time that President Biden is due to deliver his State of the Union address. What do you think about that, everybody? Wow, President Trump is set to address CPAC in a bid to extend his lease on the GOP. That's what they're saying. In the meantime, Mitch McConnell said, if he runs and wins the nomination, I will support him in 2024. So what do you think about that, everybody? Okay, so let's get right to it, everybody. Let's get right to it. I want to know what you are thinking about this, about the minimum wage. This was something that Americans campaigned on, that President Biden and Vice President Harris said, we are going to push this minimum wage to $15 an hour. And now we hear, he was in a meeting with governors just a few days ago, and President Biden said, well, you know, I don't think it's going to pass. So what do you say? You have a lot of power here. What do you say? Is this enough? Should Democrats now go on the attack? Now, Bernie Sanders is saying, we're not going to let this rest. we're going to keep on going. What do you feel ought to happen? What do you want to see happen? So let's see. I mean, because the CBO report says that raising the minimum wage will cut poverty. And Dr. Julian Malveau, leading this panel, says, when will workers get a break, for heaven's sake? When will they get a break? And, in fact, the 25 lowest pay wage-earning jobs in the United States are held by women. When will people get a break? Let's talk about this here on the Santita Jackson Show. But I'm going to get some comments from the rest of the panel. I want to get right around. We heard you a little bit just before we came up, Attorney Aaron Connolly from Covenant Strategies. What say you?
Yes, good morning, and good morning to the panel. Congrats to C.K. Hoffler on your show. That's wonderful news. And I just want to say, you're welcome. And I know you'll be covering these issues and the impact on how this is really making a huge issue worse in this pandemic for working families, right? We see women leaving the workforce at levels that are unprecedented since the 1970s. We see jobs cutting hours. We see stress and insecurity around health care. As people lose their jobs in the United States, you lose your health insurance. We do not have a proper safety net system. The COBRA system is unaffordable for many working families, and that is a big stress. So there's a lot of things in this pandemic that are being exacerbated right now. The minimum wage is, I think, the least that we can do to at least give working families and folks a little bit more. And making that a guarantee in every state, not just the privileged few states that are progressive enough to want to provide more for families. There's still big policies that the Biden administration needs to push through to do more. I think this is something that they've campaigned on and they need to work hard to follow through on. And I'm glad to see that the progressive wing is holding strong to make sure it's a priority in the Senate. And I think we, those people who support this for obvious reasons, for many of us, right, it can make a difference for feeding families and people staying in their homes. I think anybody that is trying to raise it to $10 clearly has never been in a situation where they're worried about losing their housing or how they're going to feed their children or pay their utility bill. I think the privilege of the Senate is on display with some of these half measures. And $15 is the least we can do. And as the federal government of the United States of America, we should be doing everything we can to keep as many families out of poverty and away from the brink of destruction, frankly, in a pandemic that's almost lasting a year. The Trump administration abdicated that responsibility, and we can't leave it up to the states to do the right thing any longer. And we have to lead the way as the federal government of the United States. And I really hope that it finds a way back in, and that it's something that we fight for. But we'll see if there's the political capital to get it done, is my concern. Hmm.
Dwight McKee, what do you say?
Well, I see things a little differently. To me, the problem with the minimum wage is, for most people, the minimum wage also becomes the maximum wage. I think that wages should be tied to revenue, as dividends are. Is that dividends are tied into revenue. The more money the company makes, the more money the investors make. Whereas wages get locked in and increase the inequity between the bottom and the top. Is that if wages were tied to revenue, then the more profits that the company make, then the more profits that the workers would be cut into, as opposed to them being locked into $13, $14, $15 an hour as a ceiling. Whereas the dividend holders have no ceiling. They make hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars sometimes, depending on how the stock is distributed. And so I think there has to be kind of a reorientation of how this works, because to me, what a worker does is guarantee his labor. He does not guarantee the owner's profit. That's not his job. His job is to negotiate his labor and what he brings to the table. And so it should be tied into revenue and profits, in my opinion.
Mm. Robert Petillo, what say you?
Well, you know, this is one of those issues that's endemic of late stage capitalism, where the economic systems which were created during the Middle Ages, for the most part, start falling apart. The entire discussion on the minimum wage is stupid. I think that's the beginning point. People should not have to beg for wages. We always talk about the market and the free hand of the economy and rising tide lifts all boats. That's all malarkey, and we all know that. At the same time, the CEO pay is going up by thousands of percentage points per year. The minimum wage, quote unquote, has remained stagnant. Now, let's remember that even though we talk about the federal minimum wage still being $7.25 an hour, in Georgia, the state minimum wage is still $5.15 an hour. That's what it was when I was in high school. It remains the same today. And the only reason that people in Georgia get paid $7.25 an hour is because the federal minimum wage is higher than the state level minimum wage. And this is why it's crucial for us to rethink the way that we allocate this. We cannot simply wait for an act of Congress every decade or so to raise the minimum wage. If we want to be smart about reform, then you just index it to the poverty line in a geo-fenced area. So as the poverty line goes up, the minimum wage should grow right along with it. That way it can account for rises in the market and also dips in the market. Many of the arguments people have had against raising the minimum wage have disappeared going forward. They said, well, it'll lead to automation. Well, guess what? Corona did more for automation than raising the minimum wage has ever done. They said, well, raise the price of products. If you look at Seattle, a hamburger in Seattle costs about the same as a hamburger in Mississippi does. So that's not really an argument about it, because clearly corporations have figured out how to deal with it. When you're talking about how it affects small and mid-sized businesses, we encounter this in labor law all the time, which is you have a employee requirement for it to kick in. So it gradually you have it gradually kick in over the course of 5 years. And then also you say something like if you're a corporation over 500 employees, something along those lines, there's a different minimum wage for that than for your average mom-and-pop store, the same way we do with waitress wages, so on and so forth. So there's ways to structure the legislation that will mollify any of the objections to it. The reason that we haven't done it because we lack the political will to do it, because the people making the decisions are so far removed from the concept of living on minimum wage, they can't even understand what the average people are going through. We had one congressman saying, well, I made $6 an hour when I was a child making minimum wage. They adjusted it for inflation. He made $24 an hour by today's money. So we have to have real conversation on these things with real people. And then also, people don't understand Keynesian economics. People still think we're dealing with the Austrian school and austerity, something along those lines. When you give people who are of low means more money, they don't stick it in a offshore account. They don't put it into the stock market or a hedge fund. They spend it. So when you raise wages for low-income employees, you're also raising wages for landlords because they're getting paid on time. You're raising wages for grocery workers and revenue for grocery stores because they're paying for groceries. You're raising wages and employing people in child care because they can actually afford a babysitter instead of, as we saw this week, a young woman who had to leave her children in their hotel room while she went to work to try to make money and ended up getting arrested. Mm-hmm. The system is so broken against the downtrodden in the society, and the truth is the power corrupts absolutely, and absolute power corrupts even more than that. And these people who go to Congress as these well-meaning reformers, they get sucked into the dinner parties and the cocktail hours and the smoothing with lobbyists, and the people who get forgotten are the folks at the bottom. Then that's the only way you can have a minimum wage that doesn't move for a decade and a half, and the entire proletariat doesn't rise up around it. So we're going to have to start having real conversations. The one we're having right now in Congress is frankly silly, and it's not based on any empirical facts. It's all emotions and corporate spin that's been written by lobbyists for the restaurant industry and other industries to ensure they can continue paying slave wages, because as we know in America, as long as you call slavery something different, it's fine. Just don't call it slavery. Call it wage slavery, something along those lines, even though effectively it's the exact same thing.
Hmm. Janelle from Chicago, what say you?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Janelle.
My name is Good morning. My name is Jerome Kong from Chicago, Illinois. So
while
I'm all for the raise of minimum wage, all for it. So you say, so like myself, somebody has been to college and has student loan debt, and if they raise the minimum wage, so now with the college degree, I'm just at a little bit over $15 an hour. So if they raise the minimum wage for the person that works at McDonald's for $15 an hour, which I'm all for it, that just has a high school diploma, do they raise the wage for the field that I'm in? Because now we'll be at the same wage. That's just my question and my concern. Because now, you know, I'm really in debt with student loans, and I'm just barely making $15. Matter of fact, I'm working two jobs. But what I do like is the fact that it seems that they have lifted the lid, so to speak. You know, a lot of my friends are homeowners now. So mm-hmm. I did things like there's a shift in that, which is really good, and I'm really proud of that fact. But with the minimum wage, where does that leave people that have graduated from college, you know, that are barely making that much?
Well, you know, it's just...
Do we get a raise? If they raise, do we raise?
No, clearly not. I mean, and even people who've been working on a job who haven't been to college, but who do the job in a most excellent way, what about them? You know, I mean, I'm just... You know, I mean, because the fact is, people can't live on $15 an hour, Dr. Malvo.
No, the sister's question is very interesting mm-hmm. because basically what will happen is that wages will eventually move up. So she was talking about having been to college, making just a mm-hmm. little bit over the $15. And, you know, the other person, the first thing people have to remember is that this is gradual. It's not going to be overnight. The second thing that people need to remember is that the entire wage structure then becomes flexible upward. Now, the third thing, and I neglected to make this point when I spoke earlier, is that raising the minimum wage actually cuts our taxes. How? Most people who are at the bottom are getting some kind of government assistance. It mm-hmm. might be food stamps, might be subsidized housing. When they move out of the minimum, you know, out of the bottom, basically there'll be less food stamps. That less because of the government cuts them, but less because they'll have their wages will allow them to basically have food. So it's worth thinking about the fact that the minimum wage is it's the bottom and it's going to be gradual. It will save us tax dollars, and it will affect the wage structure overall. Now, the student loan question is a whole other one. Black women have more student loans than any other demographic group, more student loans than black men, you know, Latino men and women, white men and women. We carry more debt than anybody else does. And I'm not sure why that is. Obviously, costs of college have gone up faster than inflation, mm-hmm. and students have been forced to take loans out if they want to matriculate. So there are questions to be raised about the student loan issue. Biden says he wants to forgive $10,000 of it. But we need Bernie on this one. We need Bernie on mm-hmm. this one.
Well, you know, I think we also need Kamala Harris on this because she can go past the advice of the parliamentarian. I mean, I think this is something that people really need to be fighting about because people out here... People are struggling. They're not just struggling. I'll say this before I bring on Tanya. I went out to lunch yesterday with a very, very one of my dearest friends in the world. We said we're going to go out, and we were appropriately spaced and all of that, masked up, all that, except for when we were eating our food. But you know what was interesting? She said, okay, now when I come and pick you up, I need you to be downstairs and hurry and get to the car because the carjackings have gone through the roof. And I don't sit in my car anywhere, including at a stoplight long. Okay? This is the kind of stuff that happens when, oh, yeah. And she said, no, I also don't take this expressway because there's a lot of shooting on this expressway here in Chicago because folks have no money. And when you have no money, a lot of things go out the window. Decorum, that's gone. People are desperate. Desperate. Let me go to you, Tanya. Tanya, what's on your mind?
Good morning. Good morning.
And, good morning.
As usual, I am. I'm on a rant again, especially about this minimum wage, because I just think the arguments are ridiculous. I'm just shaking my head. You know, I'm thinking Biden. You know, he's trying to. Yeah, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I literally think he's just trying to throw this presidency away, because if you can, without congressional approval, drop a bomb on somebody, but you can't take action on the minimum wage or making sure that Americans who are about to lose homes, have lost jobs, losing medical care, you can't get them $1,400 in their pocket after 1 year, but you can drop a bomb, that really puts things in perspective for me. This is ridiculous. We should not be having this conversation. Somebody who is not even an elected official talking about, we don't need to do this. Who are you? The question is, who do you represent? You're already breaking promises left and right. We still haven't gotten to 2,000. Then we went to 1,400. Still haven't worked that out. Now the minimum wage. You know, you don't even want to bring that up to the as a discussion. Of course, this is why we need Bernie Sanders. People like Bernie, we need progressive voices to really hold their feet to the fire, including ourselves, because this is ridiculous. We should not be having this conversation. Literally.
Well, we had that chance last year. We said no because we saw someone who knew our hearts, right? Very quickly, I got about 30 seconds. What do you want to ask Attorney Hoffler?
Well, what I want to ask Attorney Hoffler is how regarding we in healthcare, we've been,
Let me be fair to you, yeah. Tanya. We're going to get on the other side of the break. I want you to ask Attorney Hoffler this question because clearly it is about, it's involving employment law. And there's just a lot going on. What do you think about this minimum wage, everybody? What do you think about it? Do you need more money? Do you need a livable wage? $15 is not even enough. I mean, people like Dr. Malveaux said, wait a minute, if you scale it to cost of living, it's way above $15, way above that. So what about this? The 25 lowest wage paying jobs in the U.S., women usually hold them. Got to talk about that on the Santita Jackson Show.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Hey. Welcome to the Santita Jackson Show, WCPT 820, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station, AM 950 Radio, the voice of progressive Minnesota. We're talking about the minimum wage. Well, it seems like that might be sacrificed for the COVID-19 stimulus bill. But does it need to be, everybody? Does it need to be? The parliamentarian, the in-house referee for Congress said, you know what? You can't put this in this bill. Senate, you can't, because this is just it's incorrect. But this is advice. It's not instruction. It turns out that, you know, the vice president could overturn that. And maybe we need to push to make that happen, because $15 an hour is not enough to get people out of poverty. It's just not. It's not. And of course, joining attorney C.K. Hoffler, Dr. Julian Malveaux, and attorney Aaron Connolly and Dwight McKee and attorney Robert Petillo, the author of First and Only, A Black Woman's Guide to Thriving at Work and in Life. And you just heard, before we could welcome you on properly, attorney C.K. Hoffler, you got to get on her radio show. She's on WAOK on Tuesdays from 10 to 11 Central Standard Time, 11 to 12 Eastern Standard Time. I have that right, C.K.? No, mute. You say the most glorious things on mute. It's 11 to 12 Eastern Standard Time. Oh, you were. But I just wanted to know, you're on your Tuesday show is from 11 to 12 on Eastern Standard Time. Okay,
correct.
Perfect. When we talk about black women and, indigenous women and Latinas, make less money than black women do. But we're all in the same game, because white women don't make as much money as white men. And we all got a problem here. No one seems to be hearing us. My father often says, you know, a gallon of milk costs the same for everybody. wherever you go. So what do you say, Jennifer, with all of your organizing? Because you're not only an author, you have been a political, not just activist, you've been an organizer. You've had to, when you organize people, you got to make a case and go and talk to them and bring them in. Now, you had to go out and make a case and get them under the tent to have them vote for then Vice President Biden. And he campaigned on minimum wage. He tells the governors a few weeks ago, I don't think it's going to get through. Then you got the parliamentarian who says, well, you shouldn't put this in the bill. And now it's a dead issue. What say you?
Well, I find it ironic the way that we are so committed to gradualism and incrementalism. And that minimum wage should be in, $15 is not enough to afford a two-bedroom apartment in most cities, but it is better than what some people have. To me, that is the floor of what can be done. It's not the ceiling. And when you factor in the impact of the COVID-19, particularly on women, and we know that women head many households, and the fact that women are most likely to have left the job market, are most likely to have either been laid off or let go because their companies have shuttered. And then when you factor in that impact and you couple that with backtracking on the minimum wage, to me, that is unjust. What's interesting to me is, you know, when Republicans are leading and when they're in control, they don't have this fear of whether or not something is going to move forward. They push for it and they make it happen. And I think we need that same vigor because women, and we know that if it impacts women, it has a disproportionate impact on women of color and, mm-hmm. and even a further impact on black women. But they're relying on this. The $15 is a floor and not a ceiling, but we can't rip the rug out from under people, and that feels like that is what is happening.
So what do you say? I mean, Robert Petillo, when you talk to your radio audience on Sunday, I do think that people are going to be reacting to this, or do you think people are just shrugging their shoulders and saying, meh, they weren't going to fight for it, so, you know, let it go?
Well, you know, I think that's the biggest risk that Democrats have, which is the coalition that came together in order to win the election and then to win the runoff in Georgia. It consisted in large part of poor people, of young people, of minorities throughout the country. And if they decide, if these are, there are a lot of first-time voters and people who are not involved in the political system, and if they simply shrug their shoulders and stay home next election, that's how you lose. You're not going to bring that many Joe Manchins along with you. There are not that many blue-collar, Rust Belt Democrats anymore. They're going to come back to the party, and I don't know why we keep campaigning to them like it's 1980 again. That's not where the parties are anymore. Democrats are the majority party in America by a large and wide margin, but they govern as a minority party. They're a party that has won every popular vote for the last 30 years except for one election, but yet still they need to kowtow to the minority party, which in the Senate represents nearly 40 million fewer people than them. The Democrats are negotiating from a position of power, not a position of fear. And we saw this exact same thing happen when President Obama was elected and had an even bigger Senate majority, had a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, and they decided to govern as moderates instead of pushing through the agenda items that would help America, and that's what led to the Tea Party Revolution. People forget how low Obama's approval ratings were. People forget that he nearly lost that race to Mitt Romney in 2012. Mm-hmm. It's easy with the backdrop of history to forget, but that those moderate policies and not motivating your base nearly ended the Obama era early, and if they continue to do the same thing this time around, and they don't push for things such as student loan reform, they don't push for things such as $15 minimum wage, they don't get these stimulus checks through. Let's note that it was quicker to drop bombs on Syria than to drop money into your bank account. How does that make sense? That somehow we mysteriously find money to bomb brown people. I mean, it's under the couch, it's under the between the sofa cushions. We always find money for that. But if it's actually feeding brown people and clothing brown people and helping them be able to take care of their children, we broke all of a sudden. We can't afford $12 million for a commission on reparations, but we can pay $140 million for Trump golf trips. We got to get our priorities in order in this country, and it starts with our political leadership having that same courage that Republicans have, because they will push through of the most unpopular policies, and you'll just have to swallow it. Muslim ban, I think it was polling at 30%. They did it. Building the wall, I think it was polling under 40% also. They went ahead and did it because they are about action. They govern as a majority despite having a minority.
Mm. Tanya, you had a question for Attorney C.K. Hoffler.
Yes, and it has to do with this, and I'm thinking some other places, some other hospital organizations are going to have the same issue. With the whole COVID explosion and all of that, employees were given a COVID bonus, and they were supposed to honor that bonus this month. It didn't happen at our hospital, and so people are up in arms about it. And, you know, there's been some back and forth about, oh, we're sorry. We didn't know you didn't receive your bonuses. And so people are now feeling like, oh, they don't have an option. You know, what do we do? They said they were going to give us, you know, this COVID bonus. We signed off on it. We agreed to it. And now it doesn't show up in our bank accounts. So my question is, what is there any kind of recourse that employees have in that instance?
Well, that's an excellent question, and let me just speak very generally. When you said you signed off on it, was there a contract? Were you all required to sign something in writing with a company or with a hospital promise to do that?
Yes.
And so that's a breach of contract.
We were.
So absolutely. Presumably, if you sign something, and typically when you have contracts like that, you also have clauses that talk about breach. What happens if one party or the other doesn't hold up their end of the bargain, and that should give you the recourse. And particularly when in a pandemic, you all are signing something. When there's a contract, you have a meeting of the minds. You are doing this, and they are doing that. And so your first recourse is to look at that, and it should be, I would recommend, that you all do it as a group. Certainly individuals can go ahead and try to address this issue, but there's more strength in numbers in a situation like this, because if the hospital promised this, and it's in writing, and the party signed it, you all signed it, and the hospital administrator signed it, then you have a bona fide contract, and they are in breach. So your recourse would be the remedy for a breach of contract. They need to make you whole.
Okay.
So, yes, you do have and what state is in? And you've got to, you know, look, I'm just giving you general parameters because I don't know the state. I don't know, but I haven't seen the contract. But just as a general concept, when there is a contract between two parties and one party breaches, i.e., they don't pay you your money, and they're supposed to, mm-hmm. by date certain, then you do have remedies at your disposal. And that's what you need to look at. So start with that contract. Start with that document, because most contracts do have a provision that gives you what the remedy is if somebody breaches or doesn't do what they're supposed to do. Breach just means doesn't do what they're supposed to do.
Hmm.
So
you know, let me.
Did that
help you, Tanya?
Respond to Robert,
of course.
That helps a lot.
Yes, hold on one moment. Thank you. Thank you, Tanya. Thank you. Yes,
thank
Dwight.
You.
Of course.
Yeah. Robert, don't confuse those who vote with those who govern. Is that both parties are governed by Goldman Sachs. All of the Secretary of the Treasuries and the heads of the Federal Reserves have come out of Goldman Sachs probably for the last 30 years. And Goldman Sachs makes their money in the stock market. And so how that money is made is that you minimize wages so you can maximize profits. And then they take those profits and pass it around to themselves and their buddy and use the Treasury to leverage that and to hypothecate that. And so both the parties belong to the same little corporate crowd, and that's who ultimately is responsible for that legislation which minimizes the minimum wage. That's why I say that the minimum wage also becomes the maximum wage. Mm-hmm. But there's no maximum profits on dividends. You can make for Amazon, for example, Jeff Bezos, or whatever his name is.
Bezos,
you know, he must have made $40 billion in the last 2 years.
Oh, he's on track to becoming a trillionaire, Dwight. A trillionaire.
And that money is coming from the bottom up.
Oh, my gosh. You know, let me, before I go to Carrie from Champaign, I haven't heard from you in a long time, Carrie. You know, Jennifer, you craft messages, okay? You're a PR guru. How should Democrats, how should people, see, this is transpartisan for me, Jennifer, and Aaron, before I go to Carrie. This is a transpartisan issue. I mean, all women, whatever our color, from white to black, and every color in between, we don't make what we're worth. We don't. And we're supporting our households. And you just heard Dwight say, you know, we need to really reframe this and begin to look at tying, as we tie stock options to revenues, people's wages should be tied to them, too. We're seeing Wall Street is controlling Main Street because they're controlling Congress. That is what Dick Durbin, our senator, said in 2008, at the end of the 2008 cycle. He said, if we're honest, I'm paraphrasing him, Goldman Sachs runs this place. Wow. What can be said? Because people are really, they're desperate for not $1,400, not $600, $2,000. And, you know, Bernie Sanders said it needs to be $2,000 a month, Jennifer. What should be done to organize, to move this along?
Well, first, I think we have to think about who we send to Congress and whether or not they are proximate to the pain of working people. When you're a millionaire or when you have not had a financial worry in a very, very long time, you have some distance. You know, you don't understand what it's like. And so I think the people who are elected, they have to be more, they have to be able to do more than to talk slick and to use compelling words. They have to be proximate to the pain of working people. And when you have people who are more proximate, I mean, most people in Congress, they're wealthy. You have very few people who are not wealthy. And so I think that that impacts what we will go for and what is accepted. The next thing is, I think that all of this is a testament to the decline of labor unions in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, labor unions have been on the decline for decades. For decades. You know, this is not a new phenomenon. And so, who is, you know, we don't have a good check on these corporations because labor unions have declined. And to the extent that you could send people to Congress who are proximate to the pain, and to the extent that you could really beef up labor unions and specifically have some that are focused on women and what women need, that, you know, that's the constituency, then I think that, you know, we may be able to level the playing field to, you know, to a certain extent.
Well, Aaron, what do you say before I go to Carrie from Champaign? Because you do a lot of organizing, and you do, Jennifer, she organizes in these really tough states like Arizona. Has the nerve to go in as a progressive. Yeah, God bless her. Ooh, hallelujah. So, I mean, how would you make this case in Arizona?
Well, the reality is that the progressive folks, the moms, the people that are living these realities are not getting funded by the party and they're not getting supported. So we need to do a better job of empowering those voices within a structure that is used to elevating the voices that are supporting these corporate folks still. And that's the reality that we see on the ground in places like Arizona. We look at someone like Kyrsten Sinema, who was much more progressive when she was a member of the state legislature in Arizona, and much more liberal when she was a congresswoman from Arizona than she is as a senator. So we look at how people change when they are in a statewide office there. So even as we see these states go blue, the reality with policies and voting can sometimes backfire. And I think we need to really look at the folks that we are empowering to run for federal office and building the bench of local candidates. Who are they? Do they reflect our values? Do they look like our communities? Do they come from immigrant families? Are they moms? Are we, you know, pushing policies that empower moms to run for office, or are we making it more difficult, right? So I think we're seeing a lot of organizing. There's some great new groups out there that are supporting moms and folks that are newer candidates. But the reality is there's still a discrepancy in the money and who is funding these campaigns. And that makes a big difference. And the centrist candidates aren't getting it done in many ways.
They never do.
They don't win all the time. And then we're in a situation where we're disappointed in the Democrat. And, you know, we see someone like Joe Manchin making key decisions in the Senate. So I think we really need to follow the money and look at who is funding these campaigns. And we need to do a better job of focusing on races that can support candidates like moms, like people that have had to worry about paying rent and losing their house. There's a I don't know if anyone saw the testimony this week for our first Native American Interior Secretary, but she spoke very plainly about her history and her struggles. And I think we need more people that have lived that and understand that it's not just about losing your health care. It's about losing your house. It's about, as C.K. Hoffler was saying, watching women with shopping carts parade their families down the street after being kicked out of their houses. Like, we need, there's a stress and a trauma that people understand if they felt that. And I think we need to do better for the working people in this country, and we have to fund those campaigns.
You know, and let me go to Carrie from Champaign. You know, because the thing is, it's just when you get there, just don't forget. You know, because there are a lot of people who do not embrace their backgrounds, you know, because, you know, you can remember the overseer oftentimes was just a step above slavery themselves. Carrie from Champaign, what's on your mind? It's wonderful hearing your voice. It's been a long time.
It's wonderful hearing yours, Santita, and your guest. The thing that I see is that over the years, I remember when minimum wage was $3.30, and we're talking 1980. So if it's at $7.25 right now, you know, we all know that it should be $23, actually. But $15, I agree with Dwight McKee, it should be like with dividends. It should always go up. Because when I look at a low-level CEO who was a woman who worked over 17 years and walked out with a golden parachute and full financial benefits and health care and everything and left with a $4 million salary, and she retired at the age of 52. So you wrap your mind around that, and you think about the minimum wage when the Democrats who need to feed the people. It's like in football when you see Ezekiel Elliott rolling his mouth to feed. You have to feed that 81 million people if you want to keep those votes, or you're going to lose those votes. And if we let the Republicans get back in and take over, we're not going to have a minimum wage. We're not going to have no type of wage.
Well, you know what?
Slave labor.
But Carrie, you can see it's a bipartisan portrayal. And I think Dwight was making that point that, you know, these are corporatist parties and they kind of coexist. They coexist. They block. If you want to have a presidential debate, you are not going to have a third or fourth party on that stage because the Democrats and Republicans, they work with each other.
I understand that, but it's I don't mean to cut you off, but I understand
that's
that.
Okay.
One thing.
Oh, I know you do.
Too. We're so far bent to the right, it's not even funny. We're looking like Curly Neal on the floor spinning around.
But you know what? I think we're bent to the right.
Go to the left a lot.
You're right, and I don't think that's
right.
I don't think the Democrats are necessarily left. I guess that's my point. I think that wherever we are, we have to fight the power, as they say, and be clear on what the power is, right? And be clear.
Feed
the people. Feed the people and make them do it. I don't care who's in office.
81 million.
I can't give you. You can't have 81 million votes and then sit and tell the governors, "Well, minimum wage is not going to pass." No, 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 no. You're a master of the Senate. You know how to make this thing pass. You know how to do it. Make it happen.
Exactly.
Make it happen.
Exactly. Make it happen.
Make it happen. I don't want to hear anything else. Sending you much love.
Thank you.
Don't be so long next time, Carrie. So far away from me. So far away. So close and yet so far. Remember that by Frankie Valli? Yes, I do remember that. That was one of the first songs I learned when I was a kid. I love that song. But, you know, Dr. Malvo, I haven't heard from you in a hot second. In these final couple of minutes, can you, where do we go from here? I mean, you are not only an economist, but you have been an activist, a social critic, a political organizer, and you've been an educator. And you went to, I remember when you went to Bennett College for Women, you were going there to educate these young people, and you got gobsmacked when we saw the parent plus loans, the loan system change. And you were desperately trying to keep our kids in college, as were other black college presidents. It seems like we just can't get a break, to paraphrase your latest op-ed piece in the Crusader and in the NNPA syndication chain. Where do we go from here? What should we be doing?
We should be organizing. But let me say this. Anybody who Joe Biden did not run as a leftist. He did not run as a change maker. If you check Biden's record, he's always been a moderate. Mm-hmm. He pulled to the left a bit, not a lot, a bit, with the debates. And he told people what he wanted them to hear, and we heard it. Now, I believe he's obliged to keep his promises, especially about this minimum wage, but I'm not optimistic. What we have to do is organize. We have to organize, organize, organize. It's the only thing. And we have to, these people have to hear from us. So, Manchin doesn't care what Carrie Champagne thinks, but Manchin should still get a letter. They should all get letters.
Because he's got plenty of poor people in West Virginia, Dr. Malvo.
Hello. Hello. And, you know, Reverend Barber has been very critical of the whole poverty line thing. He says that officially, and that's true, officially they're about 20%, not 20, about 15% of the population is poor. But he says, he thinks it's more like 140 million people are struggling. So they're making the minimum wage, they're making more than the minimum wage, but they're still, as the sister who called earlier said, they're still on the edge. And anything, almost half of all Americans cannot afford a $400 emergency. Mm-hmm. And this is pre-COVID.
I was going to say, that's old data, too. You know it's got to be worse now.
It's pre-COVID. So, you know, we have to be organized. Working people have to organize. And we need to re-empower unions. Unions, right now, the rate of unionization is only about 12%.
Mm-hmm.
But when a black man is in a union,
I got 30 seconds.
He makes a third more than a black man who's not in a union job.
But you know what? Stay right there. Unions matter. No, stay right there. Everybody, stay with me on Facebook Live for just a few more minutes. I'm going to get some closing thoughts from this magnificent panel because they've brought up a whole lot of great, great, great issues. And we need to push, everybody. You got to push. You got to push. You got to push. I understand what everybody's politics were and what they might be. I'm not sentimental about this. What you need to do is push to make things happen. I don't care where your politics were. I don't care where you want them to be. People have to respond to your needs. There are 80 plus million votes that say that the Democrats need to move in a particular direction. Now it's on you to make it happen. Stay right here on the Santita Jackson and Friends page. I love you, everybody. I'll see you on Keep Up Alive on Sunday. But in the meantime, stay with us right here. We're going to continue this conversation for a few minutes. Santita Jackson Show, WCBT AM 950 Radio. God bless you, everybody. Have a wonderful weekend. Love you.